Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up today, we'll find out what previously unseen photos of Britain's suffragettes tell us about the fight for women's rights 100 years ago. Also, we'll learn about a life documented through music.
Music is first and foremost personal, so it's important to yourself, you know.
We'll hear from the former songwriter James Cook. And also today...
The restaurant scene is tough. There's so much competition. The only way you stay afloat in our industry is looking after your regulars and locals.
We'll find out how you survive a decade in London's turbulent restaurant scene. Plus, we'll look at what makes horror so appealing as Mexico's Day of the Dead approaches. And we'll take a look through the weekend's papers, all in the next hour, Sunday Brunch, live from London on Monocle 24. So welcome to Sunday Brunch. We'll take a look through the weekend's newspapers in around half an hour's time. You'll be surprised to learn that we're talking about, let's see, no deal Brexit, raising the stakes against Theresa May, and a cabinet mutiny. We could basically repeat each Sunday newspaper review every week and see if anybody noticed. Let's begin, though, with a story that takes us back a little bit further, because over the last year, a series of events have marked the 100th anniversary of some women getting the right to vote in the UK. Now, the campaign for women's suffrage is well known, but a new exhibition which opens soon in London will shine a light on one particularly radical part of that movement. Well, to learn more about it, I'm joined in the studio now by Carla Mitchell, who is the development director of the Four Corners Gallery. This is an exhibition of photographs by one suffragette in particular. What makes them so interesting? Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's right. So these are photographs by a woman called Nora Smythe, who was the daughter of a wealthy manufacturer in Cheshire, who came to London in about 1912. And the reason that these particular photographs are so special is that they're not actually taken about the mainstream suffragette movement. They were actually taken in East London and taken as part of a movement, a group that broke away from the mainstream movement called the East London Federation of Suffragettes. So maybe it's worth just giving a little bit of background about who they were.
Yeah, what you say a breakaway movement. What led them to break away?
Yeah, so the mainstream suffragettes was led by two women who people may have heard of, Emmeline Pankhurst and her daughter Christabel Pankhurst. And they were really interested in getting the vote for middle-class women. They thought that working-class women would benefit from middle-class women having the vote because that would help improve their conditions as well. But there wasn't a sense that working women should really be empowered to do very much for themselves. And there was another sister called Sylvia Pankhurst, who started work in East London with local women to try and directly work with them to improve their working conditions and also poverty in East London. And the reason for the break between the two was really that the mainstream movement of Emmeline and Christabel regarded working with working class women as, I suppose, being too radical or possibly socialist in the emphasis. And then also the break became irrevocable at the outbreak of the First World War because Emmeline and Christabel became very pro-war and threw themselves into propaganda for the government, for munitions factories, women's work within the munitions factories. And by contrast, the East London suffragettes and Sylvia Pankhurst were strongly pacifist, although at the outbreak of war, they weren't really able to say that because obviously there was a massive war fever at the beginning of the First World War.
It's interesting because the really sort of surface level reading of the suffrage movement says that, there is a connection between the fact that women had to step up during the First World War and do the jobs that the men had been doing before they went off to fight, and the fact that as the war is coming to an end in its final months, that's when the government moves and agrees women's suffrage. So you could argue that that support for the war might have been a sort of a canny political move in a way.
I think it probably was, although it's there's a less known fact, which is that it was actually the East End suffragettes who led a deputation of working women to meet Prime Minister Asquith in July 1914, so just before the war breaks out. And they directly put their case for why giving the vote to working class women would really enable them to transform their lives. And apparently Asquith was pretty persuaded, you know, that that was a good thing. So that had already taken place before the war broke out. But I think you're right in the sense that the war did absolutely transform the lives of women and give them far more independence. And that in a way, by the end of the war, I think the government was obliged really to recognise the vote for women, although it did actually take another 10 years for all women to get the vote.
What Norris Meyer's photos seem to document is not just the suffrage campaign, it's not just the suffragette movement, but it's all those other issues around poverty in the East End, around, you say, women's basically a putative women's rights movement.
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, her photographs and the involvement of the East London suffragettes have been compared to the kinds of community action of the women's movement in the 1970s and 1980s. So it was very much when the war broke out, they saw this immense poverty that was made far worse by the war because women's husbands went off to war and they were left absolutely destitute. The allowances often didn't arrive or from the government or arrived a long time after. So yes, the kind of photographs look at things like a cost price restaurant that was set up, which offered either very free or very low cost food, like at about 1 or 2 pence a meal. They set up mother and baby clinics at a time, obviously far before the NHS, when, you know, if somebody had a sick child, there was simply nothing they could do because they couldn't afford medical fees. They ran all sorts of other things like bootmaking, clothes making, factories for women. In particular, they set up a toy factory, which was very innovative. And that was as a result of the market for German toys being stopped during World War One. And a lot of these working women actually went on to design some of these toys, which was incredible, thinking that they were completely self-taught. So yes, it was very radical in terms of social provision. It was, for example, the toy factory had a creche attached to the factory, and women were offered £1 a week, which at the time was the working man's wage. So again, very unusual to be offering women the same wage as men, and very much feeding into campaigns about equal pay.
And you say 1918 marks the point when some women, but not all, are given the votes. Another 10 years before the vote is extended on an equal basis to men. After 1918, does this campaigning work continue, this group?
Not in the same way. In fact, they had even changed before that. So by the middle of the war, by 1916, people were becoming a lot more anti-war when conscription was brought in. And they actually changed their name to the Workers' Suffrage Federation. So they basically became pro-suffrage for men and women, because it's important to remember that all men did not have the vote either. A lot of men were disenfranchised. And then, of course, there was the Russian Revolution. And that, at the time, was seen as the, you know, heralding a new age of equality. Obviously, it was a bit more problematic as it turned out. But at the time, there was a huge movement towards a sort of international socialism and movements for equality. So by the end of the war, the organisation was very different. from at the outset. But yes, Nora Smythe and Sylvia Pankhurst did in fact go to Russia and meet Lenin, which must have been quite extraordinary.
One of the things that's interesting is that this is an exhibition of photographs from 100 years ago that documents the lives of women and children living in poverty. And only in the last few days, there have been debates about changes to the social welfare system in this country that it's claimed are landing people in poverty. So you could ask the question of the extent to which things have actually changed.
Yes, there's a lot of correspondence, in fact, between now and then. So, for example, with the cost-price restaurants, you know, we've seen the incidence of food banks going up. There is actually a Bow food bank now, which is just round the corner from where the East London suffragettes were campaigning. I think they also were very concerned around equal pay, and that is still something that, you know, there are issues around exploitation. And then also, you know, I think there are comparisons with the Me Too movement, because there were attacks against women, you know, often because of their class or status during the war. So, I mean, I think you know, there are more comparisons than not.
Than
yes,
you would, than you would,
yes,
perhaps imagine.
Yes, yes. For example, I mean, there's a very interesting story about Nora Smythe, because she actually was part of an arson. She attempted to set fire with another suffragette to the house of a prominent MP called Lewis Harcourt, who was a vehemently anti-suffrage minister in 1912. And it turned out, actually, he had a pretty dubious record in terms of assaults and other sort of attitudes towards women. So, I mean, there's some very interesting links and comparisons that could be made.
Just tell us about the exhibition, when it opens. Yes. And where it is.
Yes, so it opens on the 2nd of November. It runs till the 9th of February 2019. We're based in Bethnal Green. We're just 5 minutes walk from Bethnal Green tube station at 121 Roman Road, E2. And it's Four Corners Gallery. We're open daily and on Saturdays. Yes, and there will also be some talks and local walks as part of the exhibition. And we've also got Helen Pankhurst, who is the granddaughter of Sylvia Pankhurst, who will be talking about her grandmother and great-grandmother, who was Emmeline Pankhurst. So that should be really exciting.
Great. Well, Carla, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. Stay with us. In just a moment, we'll learn more about a life mapped out through music.
The Foreign Desk is Monocle 24's weekly global affairs programme. We tackle the world's biggest news stories, as well as those left untold.
What are we doing after ISIS is gone from there? What is going to happen to Raqqa after the liberation? We are in a vicious circle to a certain extent.
Our expert guests offer in-depth analysis and first-hand experience.
When you ask, can you imagine a Russia without Putin, after Putin, it's not a case of imagining. For us, the Russian Democratic Opposition, we have to prepare for Russia after Putin, because we cannot afford not to be ready again when big political change begins.
The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller, is available every Saturday from midday London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Now, we all have songs that mean something special to us, that mark important moments or feelings. James Cook knows about that. He's a former musician and songwriter turned journalist. He has documented his lifelong relationship with music in his debut book called Memory Songs. When he spoke to Monocle's Georgina Godwin, he began by talking about where the book begins, with the death of John Lennon.
I was only 12 at the time. I wasn't really aware of the Beatles at all, in any sense of them being, you know, this huge kind of cultural force in the 60s. My parents, my dad, he was a classical music fan, and he had one pop album, and that was Revolver.
Let me tell you how it will be.
So my brother and I discovered this album in November or something like that, and we were just playing it every day. Very strange record for a 12-year-old, a mix of styles, bizarre really, but very accessible at the same time.
I was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there.
And then one school morning, it's on the news that John Lennon, that he'd been shot.
John Lennon is dead, shot several times by a young American as he was going into his home in New York.
In a sense, it was odd sort of having to backtrack then through the records.
It was just before 11 o'clock last night when they were entering the luxury Dakota apartment building on New York's west side.
It was shocking even then.
And you write about it in the context of your own musical journey, because the book is part memoir, part music criticism, part social history, and a wonderful tale of your own life, but all sort of set to the backdrop of British cultural history and really leading to that moment in Britpop, which ends with the death of Kurt Cobain.
The lead singer of Nirvana, one of the world's most popular rock bands, has been found dead at his home in Seattle. Police said Kurt Cobain had apparently shot himself and a suicide note was found nearby.
The brief I set myself for the book was to investigate the music that kind of fed into or bled into or informed, for want of a better word, Britpop, that brief, probably unrepeatable cultural moment from 92, 93 to 95. And in that time, Cobain committed suicide, which is sort of classically given as that this was the green light for Britpop, the sort of Archduke Ferdinand moment. It kind of was, in a way, the whole resurgence of guitar music in Britain, which was unexpected. No one had seen it coming, was building. It was just the right time for it to happen. And then it explodes, and then it's given this term, or whatever you want to call it, Britpop. And suddenly it's everywhere, suddenly it's in the Red Tops, and it's just everyone knows what Britpop is.
She came from Greece, she had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College. That's where I caught her eye.
How difficult was it to choose which tracks made the cut, so to speak?
It was really difficult. I'd probably start with the experience or the person, you know, that led me in. It was a very influential school friend of mine, Duke, who got me into Bowie. I mean, I was aware of Bowie, as everyone was, but really to go back and get into those albums. The way the book started was it was going to be a series of interconnected essays about my favourite or significant songs. Someone mentioned that this probably didn't have any chance of getting published ever, and why not expand it to the story of the band, my own band, that I formed with my brother Duke. I mean, we were there sort of on the very peripheries of the Britpop moment as sort of bystanders or observers, really. Why not have that story as the through line, as the narrative that draws you through the music criticism, which might not be everyone's cup of tea, to have that as the human interest, as it were.
It's a memoir, really. It's told through your eyes, isn't it? And you start off, part one is called The Satellite Town. Now, for you, that particular satellite town was Hitchin.
Hitchin, Hertfordshire, yeah. I guess it's about 30 miles outside of London. You know, my brother and I did what many people do, not just people who form bands, and move from your satellite town or your small town to the nearest big city to try and make your fame and fortune. Early on in writing the book, I was thinking, well, you know, not everyone forms a band. Is this a good thing? And a few people said, well, no, do it. Keep it in there, because it's quite universal in a way. Almost everyone, or many people, they will move from their town to try and make their mark in whatever profession that they want to do in their lives. And it's that time is very fertile. Your late teens and early 20s, the pace of change is very rapid. So it's quite a fertile time to write about.
Give me a gun.
The Drowners by Suede, that was a sort of big bang moment, really, for my brother and I, because not only it was clearly a classic single, but their drummer Simon Gilbert, had been our drummer just prior to Suede. Been in a dozen bands, and Suede were his lucky 13. We were his unlucky 12. And it was suddenly the biggest band in Britain, Suede, in 92. So this was a spur. This was a huge spur, but also because they were doing sort of what we wanted to do, which is to combine lots of British influences, not as an anti-American thing, as it has been said subsequently, but just the sort of the artists that really spoke to us, like David Bowie, Roxy Music. Love is the drug and I need to score. Suede were channeling these people in 1992. It's enormously unfashionable to do. It's hard to remember that they were completely out of step with the time when it was the Wonder Stuff and Carter and all these groups that just didn't have that sense of style that Suede ushered in.
That Britpop moment, where does that leave us now?
No one talks about the music of the future anymore. And I try to give a bit of hope at the end of the book. You know, it's very sort of bleak. People are saying the future is, in terms of music, popular music, has been cancelled or was cancelled around 94. Many of the documentaries that you see on, it will literally stop. Music stops with the Manic Street Preachers and Nirvana. Then what comes after that? I say also that it's the last great scene or the last great movement. I don't think there are enough sufficient shared experiences for that to happen again. Britpop was crucial in the fact that it was the last big thing before the internet. You know, the Oasis were the last big UK band before the internet arrived, and then after that fragmentation. There's no unifying Radio 1, there's no unifying three music papers. Top of the Pops, with its enormous reach that it had. So that has gone, which I guess is a cause for concern, but what I tried to say at the end of the book, with Memory Songs, that someone will always, hopefully, come up with a song that will just reignite your faith in the art form. You know, someone will come up with an Umbrella or a Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor or a Video Games or something like that, you know. And it's just a 3-minute piece of art, that's all it is. It doesn't have to be linked to some important music, because important to whom? You know, the music is first and foremost personal, so it's important to yourself. You know.
Well, that's taken me back to my days drinking subsidised lager in a student bar, albeit sitting here today drinking black tea with honey while listening to it and nodding appreciatively. We all get old. James Cook is the author of Memory Songs, which is out now. He was speaking to Georgina Godwin. Well, let's hear from another author now in our weekend read. This week, it's Daryl Jones, who is a horror fanatic. He is the author of Sleeping with the Lights On, the unsettling story of horror. And as Mexico's Day of the Dead draws nearer, he spoke to Monocle's Carlota Ribello, who began by asking him about his own journey into covering this rather spooky subject.
I've been watching horror films, reading horror fiction, watching horror on television for as long as I can remember. I grew up in the UK during the 1970s, and it was a time when there was a lot of great, frightening television surrounding me, from children's TV series like Children of the Stones, to episodes of Doctor Who. to, you know, explicitly kind of horror-inflected TV series like Thriller, Supernatural, or even Tales of the Unexpected, I suppose.
Bedtime, dear. Up we go.
So it was all around me. And, you know, as I grew up, I continued to watch it and continued to be interested in it. And it dawned on me at some point that I could sort of make an academic career out of it and could sort of get paid for what I would be doing anyway. So that's what I do.
You mentioned there are some films and TV, but this book doesn't look just at that. You also go into theatre and literature as well, right?
That's right. And one of the points that I want to make is that, you know, people who don't understand or aren't familiar with horror often treat it with suspicion, as though there is something wrong with an enjoyment of or an interest in horror, as though this is in some way a symptom of some sort of disorder. One of the arguments I try to make is that if you look at the history of culture, the history of civilization, back to some of the earliest recorded documents that we have, it is a history of horror. You know, some of the foundational documents of Western literary culture. Greek tragedy, for example, is extraordinarily gory and bloodthirsty. This is a tradition that continues on through Shakespearean tragedy and Jacobean revenge tragedy, for example, so that there are elements that we would properly describe, I think, as horrific written into the history of civilization and culture.
Now, that is, as human beings, this fascination with horror. So why do you think that people like to read or watch horror content? It's way more than just liking to scare themselves.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. And so that's a very complex question to which there are a number of answers. One is, and I think we must not forget this, that the experience of horror is a pleasurable one, or can be a pleasurable one, and that the audiences for horror go there because they enjoy it. And, you know, that you laugh and scream often at the same time. The second thing to say is that horror is, and often has been, a profoundly sort of intellectual form that asks us very serious questions. Questions about our place in the order of creation, questions about the state of our soul, questions about the nature of evil, questions about what happens to us after death, questions about economic inequality and the iniquities of economic inequality, questions about what it means to have a body. This is the last thing that I want to say here, is that one of the reasons for it being interested in horror is that it takes us back, very often at all points, to our own bodies, to the sense that we are embodied, and that these bodies are often dimly understood by us, you know, in their appalling capacity for pain, for example, for transformation and metamorphosis, in their leakiness and porousness, in their stinkiness, but also in their great beauty and fecundity. And so horror takes us back to our bodies.
Essentially, horror stories are a reflection of society's taboos.
Yeah, that's right. And they tell us things about the times that we live in. And I think, you know, one of the things we know about vampires, for example, is that vampires don't cast reflections in a mirror.
Oh, I've become one. A vampire. Oh, God. Oh, God, where am I?
And you've got to ask yourself, well, why is that? And one of the reasons for that is that what's looking back from the mirror is ourselves, that we are looking at ourselves, we are seeing reflections, often distorted reflections of ourselves. So that an interest in horror often tells us things about the times that we live in as well. I came into adulthood, I suppose, in the 1980s, during the time of the AIDS crisis.
There is now a danger that has become a threat to us all.
We were being told by advertisements from the government, don't die of ignorance, this terrifying advertising campaign in which we were being told that you know, what we had to fear was in our own bodies, that our own bodies could break down, could rise up against us and would destroy us unless we controlled them.
If you ignore AIDS, it could be the death of you. So don't die of ignorance.
this leads to, 1980s body horror, as it's often called, for example, in the films of David Cronenberg, a film like The Fly, the graphic metamorphosis and decomposition, I suppose, of Jeff Goldblum's body as he transforms from man to fly.
Once two turned me into something else.
Oh, no.
A fly got into the transmitter pod with me that first time when I was alone.
Or in the books of and the works of Clive Barker, these very violent, often very brutal, but very embodied forms of horror. So that's one way of thinking about it. And if you want to think about modern culture, where are we today? It's no accident, I don't think, that since the global financial crash of a decade ago, we've seen the rise of what's often thought of as zombie culture. Beginning with books like, Max Brooks's World War Z, moving through TV series like The Walking Dead, and films like The Girl with All the Gifts, and many others besides, and that there, people are engaging in zombie walks through cities. There are adverts online for zombie-proof homes. And I think zombies have always arisen out of economic inequality. They have their origins in Caribbean culture and slavery, most particularly in voodoo. So zombies have always signified economic inequality, and zombies are a sort of mindless, lumpen proletarian mass, completely devoid of any agency or control over their own lives. And I think a lot of people have felt like that over the last decade or so, that they're not in control of their own lives, that they are the prey to forces completely beyond their control, that they have no agency. And so it's no accident, I don't think, that zombie culture has arisen.
Do you think that then for good horror story to come true, it needs to make sure that kind of tests our own limits and what we can tolerate a bit?
Yeah, and I think horror does this very often. I think of it as an extreme form of art often that does confront us with the limits of our own tolerance, with ideas of transgression and taboo. And, it forces us to confront these limits, takes us close to these limits. And these limits, as I've suggested, are limited with our own bodies, for example, but they're limits to do with what is permissible within culture. And so one of the consequences of this is that horror has always had a very lively, actually sometimes quite fruitful, relationship with censorship. There are plenty of people out there who want to ban or purge or censor the extreme documents of horror. I've often thought that the history of horror is also in part the history of outraged responses to horror, that horror gets blamed. It gets blamed for causing crimes of various kinds, for example. And those of us who are interested in as scholars or practitioners or fans of horror often find ourselves engaged in these kinds of discussions and debates about the ethics of our subject.
Darryl Jones speaking to Carlotta Ribello. That book, Sleeping with the Lights On, The Unsettling Story of Horror, is out now. Don't forget, there's a full back catalogue of all the past editions of Meet the Writers available anytime at monocle.com. Stay with us. In just a moment, we'll look through the stories in the weekend's papers.
Tired of saying the same few tedious tourist haunts?
Well, the Monocle Travel Guide series has stopped off in 30-plus cities and counting in order to dispense advice on travelling like a local. From the finest spot in which to sip a cocktail with a contact, work up a sweat, or take a dip, our comprehensive guides are packed with tips, essays, and tidbits for getting the very best from your destination. Monocle's Travel Guide series is published by Gestalten. We've recently added Mexico City and Zurich, Basel, and Geneva to the library, with Athens and Helsinki coming soon, and guides to Chicago and Hamburg following early next year. The Monocle Travel Guide series. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
A busy weekend for the newspapers across Europe, and joining me to take a look through them is Marie Billard, journalist for French media here in London. Thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Hi.
I said at the start of the programme that we could basically have recorded any newspaper review in the last year and played it out again. As long as we just said, Brexit, car heavens, what's going to happen? That would kind of cover us. But yeah. This is kind of the crunch week, it seems. There is this summit on Wednesday night, which apparently will decide whether or not the EU is going to agree a deal. But then the UK newspapers are talking about up to 10 cabinet ministers are ready to resign. 60-odd MPs are ready to move against Theresa May. I mean, it's a bit boy who cried wolf. We've kept talking about there's going to be a crisis, it's going to be a crisis.
Yeah.
But if there's going to be a crisis, this might be the week when it happens.
Well, what's funny is that last week there were a lot of optimism thinking, oh, yeah, a deal is closer now that the Conservative conference is passed. The Europeans were more positive. In the UK, were more positives. And it was better last week. And then this week it's all coming crumbling down again. So that might do the trick, basically. Better and then definitely far worse with what's happening. But basically, what was positive last week remain positive, meaning that perhaps the UK is willing to basically do a step towards Brussels, and Brussels is ready to do a step towards the UK. The only problem is, and has always been so far, Ireland. And in an interview in Le Monde newspaper, Jean-Claude Juncker says that it's going to be Ireland first, always Ireland first, meaning that if Ireland is not happy with the deal and with the backstop, it's not going to fly. And this week in particular, it's not really about the deal or the divorce bill or the divorce deal. It's really about the backstop, the insurance policy that the EU wants, so that whatever happens with Brexit, there won't be a solid border in between Ireland and Northern Ireland on the island of Ireland.
And we should say the backstop was, if there was no deal agreed to mutual satisfaction that prevented a hard border, then the UK has already agreed it would stay in the customs union for a period that nobody knows how long it would be until something was worked out.
And that's exactly the problem. That's something that the UK has put on the table months ago. But now, this last few days, the DUP has kind of woken up and say, well, we said it was not okay. We said that calmly. We are going to make a stand now and make you understand that what we said a few months ago is still valid. And we don't want this option of staying into an EU custom. And we certainly don't want, as we've said before, to have Northern Ireland treated differently than the rest of Great Britain in terms of trade or anything else. So what the DUP is saying now, they seem a bit emboldened. They're saying that they are getting, I mean, the Observer is saying that the DUP is getting ready for a no deal. And the DUP is getting ready for a no deal because they might be the one from whom the no deal happened, because they are ready to make a stand and have the Brexit negotiation collapse because of that. And even before the Brexit negotiation, they are ready to basically weaken the government even more by voting down the budget at the end of the month. We would basically trigger a government crisis. With all those threats, Theresa May is going to show her plan for the backstop to her government, the entire government, on Tuesday. And we already know that from the hearsay that the Brexiters heard about her plan, they're really not happy already. And we know what happened last time. I mean, exactly the same scenario as Chequers. You find it, you kind of think that the UK hasn't really heard the definition of craziness, which is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting to have another issue. Last time for Chequers, she presented it to friends. Friends were happy with the Chequers plan. And then she presented it to the old cabinet, and the old cabinet, amongst who they are not good friends, basically, those friends were not happy and they resigned. And she's doing exactly the same thing. She presented it to friends first, and on Tuesday she's going to present it to everyone. And we already hear that some ministers want to resign. If they do resign, that's going to be a big problem, because it would mean that each time Theresa May makes a move, she loses a bit of a cabinet, which of course is not a show of strength. And that would be just the day before the EU summit. So she would be arriving in Brussels very weakened. And we remember Salzburg. She left quite strong, she arrived quite strong, thinking she was quite strong, and she left completely devastated. So it's not exactly a good stand for her at the moment. But this EU summit has to be a success, because the EU said that if it's not going to go well, this summit, there are not going to be another in November. And if there's no other summit in November, we don't know what's happening to negotiation. Probably it's just completely at a stop, and there's gonna have to have a dramatic solution, which is a change of head of government in the UK or a change of tack completely in the UK in terms of negotiation. The EU won't budge. So this summit, although it's on an issue, a particular issue, could indeed derail the whole negotiation.
It's a nice quiet week ahead for both of us then, I would imagine.
Yes, I think we'll be quite busy indeed, yes.
Jean-Claude Juncker, you mentioned that interview in Le Monde. He talks about a couple of other issues too.
Yes. Basically, the title of the piece is Orban doesn't have his place anymore in the PPE party. So that's basically the centre-right party in the EU parliament. And he says that the Hungarian doesn't have his place anymore because although he respects the man, the policies are too far-right for him and his ideas are too far-right for him. And he doesn't think that the values of the party is respected anymore. So basically, he's calling him to go away in a way, in a very European way of doing things, being non-critical, but at the same time blowing a hammer blow. So that's one of the issue. And of course, they go along to the refugee and immigration crisis and talking about that. And what's the interesting, I think, in this interview is that although Juncker is talking a few times in the interview about basically the need to remember the history of Europe, to remember the reason why the EU was built, basically to salvage peace, to be a humanist force in the world in terms of crisis, this interview won't inspire anyone to love Europe because it's very tamed down, it's very bureaucratic, it's very politically correct. He doesn't inspire the love he professes for the EU. And I think that's always a bit of a miss when there's a big interview from a European in a newspaper, when they fail to inspire the love they profess to have for the EU, because that's exactly what's lacking. That's exactly what didn't happen during the EU, the Brexit referendum in the UK. The love wasn't there, and they seem to not be able to convey the love and the importance they have for the EU. And I think I think that's a bit of a shame each time, because you see that they want to convey it because they say they love the EU, they say the reason why the EU is a force for good, but they are not able to reach the readers. That's my opinion anyway. And the last part of the interview is about Italy. Of course, we heard a lot about Salvini this last few weeks. And the main issue in this interview is the budget. And what Juncker says is a bit controversial. I mean, it's been a bit controversial in Italy. He said that Italy hasn't been true to her words in terms of the budget. A few years ago, they say, oh, we're gonna stick to a deficit at 0.8%. But now the new government wants to have a deficit of 2.54%. And so basically, Juncker says that Italy is not being a good boy in a way. And should be a bit careful to what he says, because we can't trust her if she doesn't if she's not true to her word. And Salvini already responded to this interview and said that the EU should shush and not say anything about Italy. And that's something that's going to fly with the partisan of Salvini, because when the EU are not able to show the love for the EU, the enemies of the EU, the criticism of the EU, are getting stronger because they have a way to talk to the people. That's populism in a way. That's how they manage to win the argument, the sentimental, the emotional argument, when the EU has a lot of difficulty to be emotional.
Now, one other political leader is featured in the FT of trying to rebuild their own image.
Yes, and it's Marine Le Pen, the leader of the National Rally. I have to think about it every time I say it, because I want to say National
changed.
Front. It's National Rally. What
mustn't
a change.
You mustn't call her National Front leader anymore.
No,
however
she's
tempting
not.
It may be.
Yes, yeah, however tempting. And, you know, the name is not too different, and what's inside is not too different either. But what Marine Le Pen wants to do is, of course, so we remember that she was at a second round for the presidential, and she lost to Emmanuel Macron very pitifully after a very bad debate between the first and the second round. Since then, the party has been having a lot of trouble, financial trouble, political troubles. It's not been a good year for Marine Le Pen. Now, they have, funny enough, they have the European election coming up, and I think they can have a better time with it. It's always very, very funny 2020 when you think that the Eurosceptic really count on the European elections. But that's exactly something. That's exactly what she wants to do. She's basically hand in hand with Salvini in that from Italy. She wants. She says that Salvini. She said in a few quotes that are in the paper in the FT. She said that Salvini has been able to be kind of a charismatic leader in Italy, and she wants to be this charismatic leader. Something she's been failing to do for quite some time. But the national rally being like the national front, the leader can't change because the Le Pen brand is completely attached to the Front National Rally brand. So what she wants to do is she's got difficulty. That's what the FT is saying, because she has to have a bigger sway in the voters in France. So she has to be not too extremist in a way, not too extreme anyway, but at the same time she doesn't want to alienate the base of the party, which will be very happy about more extreme policies on immigration, on integration and on economy. So she has a very important balancing act to do, and she has to get her act together before the European election, because after that she would have a 2 or 3 years without any major election, and that would give the time to the party to think about the change at the head of the party. So it's really basically the last chance for her. But what's very interesting in this piece of the FT is that although she's saying, well, we're going to do better, we want to do like Savini's, we're going to win the hearts of the French again, there's not any sign of any kind of policies, something a bit original that the national rally will present. So I think that's the biggest flaw of the FN. They have positioning, but in terms of policies, they're always a bit lacking.
You can change your name, or you can change one word in your name. It's not really going to change anything else, though, is it?
No, exactly not. And that's proving it very very strongly for her, because she had managed to change the party, to demonize the party in some way before the election, and then she failed it with a very bad performance. And so she thought, well, we already did the groundwork with the demonizing of the party. The election was, you know, it was bad that we lost it, but the groundwork has been done. We can build on it. The problem is that, as always with the national rally, is that they never seem to be able to build on the groundwork, and there's always something that's going wrong. It can be a controversy, that what happened with Jean-Marie Le Pen. It was going well, and then all of a sudden he says something about the gas chambers and it's all going down, and that just put the National Front then and National Rally now in the back of the queue again. And she's trying not to be controversial as her father, but at the same time, her father was popular as well because it was controversial. She's trying to be popular without being controversial, and
there isn't much else there.
And this, well, she has to prove that it's something else. So what's basically happening is at the moment they're saying, "Watch out, this space. We're gonna do something great for the European election." And that's, I mean, it's great if it's something happening. That's what you want to do in terms of communication. But the problem is, there's chances are she's saying, "Watch this space." But at the same time, if there's a vacuum in this space, that's not going to be good for the national rally. And just one last thing is that National Rally is wants to be seen as second party in France, and it's true that the opposition to En Marche, to Emmanuel Macron's party, is inexistent. The Socialist Party is inexistent.
So there is a gap there.
And there's a gap, yeah.
Just quickly before we go, tell me what was Stephen Hawking's last great fear was.
He was afraid of the superhuman. He was saying that in this century, people are going to be able to edit the gene of themselves and their children, making them more resistant to diseases and perhaps helping them to have better memories, better cognitive function as well, and it would be the rich would have access to this kind of new fangled technologies, and those who can't have access to this technology will just lag behind. That's going to create kind of a two-tier humanity, with the superhuman in a way somewhere up there, and the underhuman or the normal human under them. And what's going to happen to them? Are they going to be prevented to have kids, so that basically only superhumans stay on Earth. But I mean, that's what the piece is saying. I always think that Hawkins was scientific. He wanted to be read by everyone. So he's got words that are very easy to understand for people who are interested in science. When journalists take his word and trying to make it even more accessible to everyone, they tend to make it a bit dramatic. So yeah. That may be the dramatization of his obviously.
It could be, but it sounds an awful lot like a sort of horror book that our earlier guest who wrote about the history of horror would have been interested in. We'll have to leave it there. Mary Beale, thank you very much for coming in this morning. You're listening to Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. Now, finally today, the Welsh chef Bryn Williams is marking the 10th anniversary of his restaurant Odette's in London's Primrose Hill district. He's marking it with a special menu which showcases the best of the restaurant's food from that decade. But it raises the question, what does it take to last that long in so turbulent an industry? It's a subject he discussed with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
I was lucky enough to buy Odette's, and we've kept the name Odette's. So it's been going for 40 years as a restaurant, about 10 years under my leadership. The main reason we kept the name, because it's on the black cab on their knowledge test. So if you get into a black cab and say, Odette's, they should know exactly where it is just by saying the name alone. So that's the reason we kept the name. Yeah, 10 years, it's a milestone. I think a lot of our customers were reminding me, oh, it's been 10 years this year, 10 years this year. And I was just, as you do as a chef, you just go from week to week, month to month, year to year. So they really pushed to say we should celebrate because it is a milestone. It's a tough industry anyway, but the last 3 or 4 years, it's been especially tough in London and the restaurant scene across Britain because with prices of food going up, Brexit, you know, recessions. So it's been a tough time, but it's all down to our locals.
You are doing a lovely way to celebrate those 10 years. So there'll be 2 weeks with the best dishes of Odette's ever.
Yeah,
in a way. Tell us a bit more about
that. Yeah, so we're doing two special menus going. So we have for 2 weeks, we asked all our regular customers, what dish do you remember? What dish was your favourite? So we have some customers, Mr. and Mrs. Manton, they've been coming every Friday for the last 10 years. But if they come on a Thursday, it completely blows my mind. I go, is it Thursday or Friday? It confuses me. So we ask them, what's your favourite dish? We have about a good 100 locals that come week in, week out. So we ask them, what's your favourite dishes? We whittle it down to 6 and then we put them on specials. So we're going to try and modernise them a little bit. But what we have to remember is the reason they're not on the menu anymore because we keep evolving. So that's how we're celebrating 10 years of Odette's, by highlighting the 6 chosen dishes from our regular clientele that they want to see back or taste it. And the other way we're doing as well, which for me is the most important thing, the restaurant scene is tough. There's so much competition. And the only way you stay afloat in our industry is looking after your regulars and locals. So we have a community team in Primrose Hill. So we've done a 2-week lunch menu. Normally it's £18 for 2 courses, but for the next 2 weeks, from the 16th of October, it's £10 for 2 courses. And the reason we've kept it for lunch, because all the regulars and the locals, they walk to us. So we wanted to say a big, big thank you to them, because without them, we wouldn't be 10 years old.
Well, that's a wonderful way to celebrate, in my opinion. And you mentioned the couple that has been there almost, you know, every Friday.
Yeah.
Which dish did they choose? Is it a scallop dish?
Yeah, they chose a scallop dish. So we did a curried scallop, a hand-dived scallop from Scotland. It's lightly curried, so we season with salt and curry powder. And then we pan-fry it. Then we serve with salted grapes and a cauliflower and coconut soup. So it's got a little bit of the Asian Indian influence there, scallops and cauliflower and coconut. So it's, you know, it's a great dish, but we just moved on from there. We're a bit more classic now in our combinations of flavour. But even though coconut and cauliflower and scallop is a classic combination, but you're taking two continents, put them together, and then you serve it in North London. So we've moved on from there, but it's a great tasting dish.
And Bryn, I was reading a bit more about your food and everything. Is it true that most of the produce at Odette's, it comes from your family farm in Wales?
Yes, so for the last 3 years or so, my brother Gareth, he now grows most of our fruits and veg for us. So I have another restaurant up in North Wales called Bryn Williams Apotheria, which is all about shellfish and seafood because we're literally right on the beach in Colwyn Bay. So he supplies fruit and veg. I'd say this time of year, it's about 60-70% of our vegetables all come from the farm. So we go from onions to pears to carrots to wild strawberries. So we're very, very lucky. And that's another way we were able to keep the cost down because price of food's gone up the last 2 years, 3 years. So by producing our own vegetables, we can keep the cost down. Then we pass that cost. Well, we don't pass the cost on to our customer, but what they do get is great flavoured vegetables. You can really taste the difference. You know, when you grow your own vegetables or you buy them from supermarkets or any market, when you grow your own, they taste so much better.
How do you divide your time between your three restaurants, right?
Yes. It's tricky. When I had two, it was quite easy. If you're not in one, you're in the other. Mm-hmm. But when you got three, you're always, it's a bit of a triangle. So I try and do like a week in each restaurant. But the key to this is having great head chefs and great managers in each restaurant. So I opened Odette 10 years ago. The second restaurant didn't happen 7 years later. So until Odette was established, we had the right team, the right personnel. So we invest in people. You know, when you run a restaurant, it's the people that you rest time in. You know, you rest time in the manager and the head chef. They get to understand your ethos. They tune into that. And then you can move on to other things because you've got really, really good people in place. So that's the key to having great head chefs and managers in each restaurant. And I just go around each one, helping to change the menus, you know, just making sure that they keep to the ethos of what we believe in, which is great ingredients, cooked incredibly well, seasoned, and not mess them out too much. We just make sure we keep to that ethos across all three restaurants.
And Bryn, how would you define the cuisine at Odette for those that never been or wants to visit London?
Now, what I would say is it's classic, British, but modern. It's classic combinations of flavour. I'd say 95% British ingredients, but we just lighten things. So it's not, they're not rich, heavy, cream saucy. We just lighten things up. So they're the three words, classic, British, modern.
Bryn Williams there speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. That wraps up this edition of Sunday Brunch, produced and studio managed by George McDonough. Mariana Legrasta was our researcher. Coming up, it's the sessions of Midori House in just a moment. And an hour from now, a brand new Monocle Weekly. The news is next from me, Paul Osborne. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.